And turn there, please, the first chapter of the book of Isaiah. And I will not again go over some of the all of the mass of preliminary material. I think I've said everything I want to say about it. Let me just open though by saying that the first 12 chapters essentially constitute oracles against Jerusalem and in particularly Judah. And then the Lord moves from Jerusalem and Judah to the world after that. Now, it doesn't mean that it's all just hellfire and brimstone for Judah and Jerusalem. It is mostly. It's a series of oracles against them. But there's always little pockets of promise, of restoration, of mercy. You have the virgin birth in chapter 7, prophesying how God's ultimately going to pull this off. You have an excursus on the millennium in chapter 11. So it's not all gloom and doom, all right? But anyway, the first 12 chapters are oracles against Judah and particularly Jerusalem. Chapter 1 is God's charge against his people for failing to obey the Mosaic covenant, which was conditional. It's not that they didn't obey the Abrahamic covenant. It doesn't matter if they obeyed that or not. Well, you understand what I'm saying about that. It did matter. But if they wanted reciprocity from God, they had to observe the Mosaic covenant, which they utterly failed to do. So let's just pick it up in verse 1 and just look at you have the list of the four kings there and the scope of the timeline of all this is going to be taking place. This is the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, not to be confused with the prophet Amos, absolutely not the same people, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So he begins then the discussion, that's kind of like a headline, and he begins the discussion in verse 2 by talking about their unsuccessful upbringing. He uses imagery of a family and God himself as a parent. Notice, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me." I suppose if you think about it, and if you've ever been there, and if you ever observed life, there can be nothing in life that's more tragic than unsuccessful upbringing. And the world has no shortage of that. People every day have children. They have aspirations and hopes for those children, even if they're lost. And then it doesn't pan out and turn out the way they probably would have liked it. That, in many minds, is a tragedy. And that holds true in a double sense, for the godly upbringing of God-fearing parents. And we only have but to think of the sons of Jacob, Aaron, Eli, Samuel, David, all the people I just mentioned had severe heartache with regard to their own personal blood children. But we can also speak of this impenetrable mystery when we read that God had brought up children and that upbringing apparently failed. Therefore, it is that we hear the Lord lament right here, as in other places, about his children. And there's a lot of questions that pop up in our minds regarding this unfathomable mystery. But out of holy respect for God and his majesty, or at least I'll suppress them for now. That it nevertheless has to be viewed as a dreadful fact, I think, is apparent from the very solemn summons to the heathen and to the heavens and to the earth. In verse 2, God is summoning the whole universe to listen to this. And this is not the only place that this occurs. Moses does the exact same thing right at the beginning of his swan song in Deuteronomy 32. In verse 1, he says, "Give ear, O ye heavens, and hear, O earth." So we have Moses and Isaiah using very exacting and complimentary language. And so in it too, Israel sins in the past, her sins right at the time that Isaiah was writing, in the present, and then in the future, are going to be described. And after seven centuries, the prophet invokes the unchanged witness of God's creation, of heaven and earth, once again to listen to the Lord's lament and to be astonished at the downright hardness of Israel. The Lord had adopted those people as his firstborn son. In fact, all throughout the Old Testament, sometimes they're called a son, sometimes a daughter, sometimes children, but there's always some kind of family term for them, which makes it all the more tragic and heart-wrenching. But what the people as a whole had done in a collective sense, the individuals within Israel, they dared to do the same thing as well. They turned their proud backs upon an infinitely loving God, a very merciful Father, who also was their pedagogue. I mean, he taught them with great patience. And of course, we ought not to take the word children obviously not in a regenerative sense. It should be taken in a covenantal sense. Israel stood in a very close covenant relationship to God, and that relationship is usually expressed as that of a man to his wife, or a father to his children. Especially in Deuteronomy, Moses does this again and again. Jeremiah does this frequently. Hosea, you find it in many different places. In other places, the people of Israel, they're called brethren, particularly in both 1st and 2nd Chronicles. So the whole covenant idea is basically predominant with all the prophets, and Isaiah, of course, would be no exception. And for that reason, God is very often called the God of the fathers, constantly referring back to the patriarchs and what God had done through those men in instilling the Abrahamic covenant, and even Moses, in a sense, is considered a father with regard to the Mosaic covenant. In fact, in Chronicles, God of the Fathers, in Chronicles, that term is found some 30 times, and that's not by accident. Now, notice in verse 2, you have this expression, nourished. Okay, you see that word points to the fact that God formed Israel. He delivered her from Egyptian bondage, and he led her through the desert and into the promised land, into Canaan. And then ultimately made her into a great nation under David and then Solomon. And then you see the words brought up. That indicates that God made Israel the firstborn among the nations. Exodus 19:6 called her a kingdom of priests. And I'm trusting that you know what a priest is. A go-between. Between the world and God. They were supposed to be that liaison between the lost humanity and a God that wanted to save them. But notice it says in verse 2, but they have rebelled against me. What? That's the plaintive conclusion. What a sad statement. I mean, as far as sin is concerned, Scripture has no shortage of expressions, especially in the Old Testament. There's some 20 different words to show the various nuances of sin and how it can rear its ugly head. The most frequent of them are forsaking the Lord, doing evil in the sight of the Lord, acting foolishly. Remember the four words for fool, various usages of that. Acting wickedly, departing from God, wandering away, trespassing against the Lord, playing the harlot, provoking the Lord. All of these various expressions using very expressive and vivid words that show pictures of how God felt and how much he was aware of what was going on in all of its various forms. And sin is always directed against the personal God that had personally revealed himself to these people. It's always, notice, they have transgressed against who? Verse 2, against me. It's always against me. Against God. The transgression of his law is not so much against the law, it is as much as it is, though, against him. It's a thumbs down to him. I mean, if God was to reveal himself today, he would utter essentially the same complaint. In fact, this is so intense. He moves now to other illustrations, like oxen and ass, to make his point. He's going to compare Israel to beasts that actually do better than they did. Notice verse 3. The ox knoweth his owner, and the ass his master's crib. In other words, these animals have natural instincts that they're inbred with. But Israel doth not know. My people doth not consider. I mean, Isaiah is a master craftsman. Now, he's being superintended by the Holy Spirit for sure, but he knows the secret of using the striking and really many, many times, as far as Isaiah is concerned, original similes. That like nobody else has ever used similes. That's one of the main characteristics of Isaiah's style. He's the simile master. And because of that, his style is characterized by an unbelievable vocabulary. It's very difficult Hebrew. And very great vividness. And that kind of writing style lends itself to tremendous power. The comparison he uses here in this verse, verse 3, basically is, I mean, which actually one of the better well-known verses that opens up the book. An ox is one of the least intelligent animals, but the ox knows his owner. The ox knows who owns him, where he gets his food from. When he's hungry, he walks up to the owner and he'll low, right? Is that the word? My wife could tell me. I think they low. They do that to make their need known. That's the way they say, I'm hungry. They ask for food that way. But of course, that's not what Israel does. She quiets the hunger of her heart with Baal and Ashtaroth and any other type of pagan god. She demonstrated absolutely no knowledge of the Lord whatsoever, who has just been presented as her father. So comparing his people with an ass, not only just an ox, but an ass, a donkey, and that serves to even strengthen the alarming nature of the whole scenario. Usually an ass is considered the dumbest and most stubborn of all the animals. Now, there's a difference between Oriental donkeys and Western donkeys. At least I'm told that there is. But in the earliest antiquity, the donkey was a useful domesticated animal, especially in the East. And couple the donkey with the camel, and that was basically a major means of transportation. I mean, there was no cars, there were no motor scooters, there wasn't bikes, there wasn't anything like that. I mean, you got around by camel and by mostly donkey if you traveled at all in a way that was basically not on your feet, you see. And it provided good transportation. The Lord rode donkeys, particularly in Zechariah 9:9 and the whole so-called triumphal entry. But the eastern ass is bigger, and it's actually better looking. It looks more like a horse than the occidental donkey. Occidental meaning the western, the ones that we see in the old westerns, the ones that won't move and won't budge, those kind of guys. And I don't know what the reason for that is. Maybe the warm climate of the Orient suits that animal better than the cold, wetter climate of the West. I mean, even though it's said that the ass in the East is not as stupid as our donkey is, but it's pretty clear that he's mentioned here with the ox as one of the dumbest animals. There's a reason for the coupling and the pairing of these two particularly. And nevertheless, he shows evidence of knowledge, and dare we call it obedience. An animal can obey, and even a type of an attachment to its master. They both show that. And even when it's far from home, he loves his stable, and the donkey knows how to find it. He'll make his way back. He has like a tracking device inside of him. Once he knows where he lives, he wants to go back, you see. And he finds it again. Now the whole point of that, the whole point of verse 3, is that that was not the case with Israel. The people had no knowledge of the Lord or of the blessings of his covenant. They had some external knowledge. Some of them had a knowledge of history, but they did not understand God's love for them. They didn't have a knowledge of the kind of love that God requested of them that would seek Him and want to serve Him. The Lord Jesus said, "I am the good shepherd, and know my sheep, and am known of mine." That knowledge of love, Israel absolutely lacked. And they lacked it thoroughly. They lacked it completely. She did not seek the Lord. She left Him to go whoring after other gods. And so the irrational animal, the dumbest of the lot, actually put Israel to shame. Like the poet says, "By bit and bridle, guided by man's skillful hand, are kept in check the beasts that do not understand." In any event, the reins of the law of the Lord, they made powerless by the flesh. They didn't keep Israel from an unbridled sensuality and ultimately every conceivable sin that came down the pike. So what Isaiah does now is he utters a sevenfold woe. And I'll explain that in just a second. Verse 4. Is an expression of just, like that, you know. Sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the, see the all caps? That's Jehovah. They forsook Jehovah. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They have gone away backward. For them it was two steps forward and three steps back. Now Isaiah, more than any other prophet, is fond of the number seven. That's his number. Now he doesn't mention it very often, but he does give many descriptions that would, whenever he goes into a detailed description, it normally has a sevenfold feature to it. There's seven elements to the example. And as we make our way through, we'll have a lot of opportunity to call attention to examples of this. And we'll also see that the number seven is not the number of perfection, but of completeness, whether that be in a positive or a negative sense. And that it's usually divided into two parts. You'll have a part of four, let's say positives, and then three negatives. Or you'll have four negatives and then three positives, okay? And that's also the case in this verse. First, he describes in four powerful phrases the sinful life and the evil mentality of Israel, right in verse 4. And then in three more, you have the wicked deeds of Israel in regard to its walk and its word and its will. Right, those are enumerated. And again, I point you to Exodus 19:6. Israel was, God challenged them. He told them they were to be a holy nation, but instead they are a sinful nation. In fact, the word goy is the word used here. That was usually reserved for the Gentiles. It's interesting that, you see, that's one of the beauties of being able to look at the original text. God's using a word normally in Scripture reserved for the Gentiles, for them. The word for sin points to, this is the word for missing the goal. This is the one that Paul carries over, this particular concept of sin. Paul carries over into Romans 3 and verse 23. But by unbelief and by disobedience, Israel had already completely missed the goal, and she'd been doing it now for centuries. Remember at the very beginning, at the split, all the godly people flooded south into Judah? But as soon as that generation was gone, there was not much left, you know? Instead of being a holy covenant people that was very closely related to its God, Israel became like the heathen nations and just basically aped all their sin and consequently went through all their misery. Look at verse 4 again. A people laden with iniquity. They're just saddled with it. It's like they took their garments off and soaked them in iniquity and then put them back on again. Her iniquities weighed her down like a heavy load. All the misery she had to bear from the world powers were all together the result of her iniquities. And a lot of the commentators feel that Ahaz primarily is in view here. Everything is leading up to the atrocities of that guy. And I don't know if that's true. It can't be proven because it doesn't say that yet, but that may be the case. I mean, this is the beauty of reading the prophets. It's easy to make application if you're just thinking straight. I mean, I'm reading through the opening statements of Isaiah. What should I be thinking to myself? Besides understanding the text, if I understand the text correctly, now I can make application. What's my application? My application is that no man and no people ever sin cheaply. Sin is not cheap. Whoever commits evil is going to bear the responsibility for it. Heaviness. Evil always calls for some kind of recompense. I want to forsake God, the fountain of all good things in my life. Well, I'm going to have to face grief, after grief, after grief, after grief. That's the way I want to go. So the prophet, with all of his rich vocabulary, you notice he calls them a seed of... See how expressive these words are. See, this is the beauty of just slowing down. Think about that. A seed of evildoers. These wicked people, originally, they're the seed of Abraham. Ever boasting of being that. I mean, that was their pride and joy. And now they've become, by virtue of the fact that they're so wicked, a generation of vipers and children of the devil. That's what Jesus called them. Especially in John 8. That's how terribly sin corrupts and degenerates man. You see the phrase, verse 4? Children that are corruptors. Here's my wicked son, my horrible daughter. The degenerated children that, according to verse 2, had forsaken their father, have thereby corrupted themselves and others, and as corruptors, they themselves now are headed for eternal corruption. As soon as the son, in the most famous parable of all time, as soon as he left the house of the father, he immediately starts to corrupt himself. And you know what he does. You know the story. He squanders his possession. His health begins to give way. It's one harlot after another. In fact, in Revelation 11 and verse 18, the wicked are called those who destroy the earth. Well, here's our number 7 again. Now with 3 forceful strokes, Israel's finally depicted in her wicked manner of life. So, by mentioning these 7 aspects of Israel's wickedness, Isaiah now, of course, being directed by the Spirit of God, he's given a complete presentation of the sins of the people. And he's just going to continue to compare Israel's condition with that of a mortally sick person. Think of a guy that's just absolutely sick. I mean, no healing could possibly be expected anymore because this cancer of sin had spread, and now it's in the whole body, from the top of the head to the sole of the foot. And so consequently, you read something like you find in 2 Chronicles 36 and verse 16, the wrath of the Lord arose against his people till there was no remedy, it says there. Now, you see that name of God there? He's called there the Holy One of Israel. All right. That name appears 12 times, Holy One of Israel, in the first 39 chapters, which is the first section. And then 17 more times in chapters 40 through 66. So that means you have that phrase used to depict God, the Holy One of Israel, 29 times in the book of Isaiah. So now in verses 5 and 6, he's going to go on to elaborate on this incurable sickness, the pervasiveness of the disease from the foot down to the head. Notice the verses. Verse 5. Why should you be stricken anymore? Ye will revolt and more. The whole head is sick. The whole heart faint. Verse 6. That, no pun intended there. Is that a Freudian slip or what? From the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there is no soundness in it. but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. It's the picture of the guy that got beat up by the robbers in the account of the Good Samaritan. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. In other words, God had sent horrible calamities on Israel in the days when Isaiah was speaking these words. By the way, he preached this. He didn't just write it down. He preached it. This was the substance of his preaching. That's why he got himself sawed in half. Now, it can't be determined with absolute certainty what exact judgments the prophets had in mind. A lot of guys think of the heavy blows that the country sustained in the day of Ahaz. In fact, almost everybody thinks that because a lot happened at that time, that when Ahaz took over. It seems that that is really probably the case. That degenerated criminal, he did not take the divine blows to heart. Some are just so thick, no matter how much you whip them, it's just not going to work. In fact, on the contrary, you read specifically of Ahaz that the more that he was visited, the more he trespassed against the Lord. He didn't have time to do it. That's exactly what 2 Chronicles 28 and verse 22 says. The more God tried to get his attention, the harder the man got. Notice again verse 5. I think verse 5 actually alludes to that. The people had refused to accept fatherly chastisement. And that's one of the hardest aspects of discipline, is when you have a son or a daughter and they're so utterly recalcitrant and they remain completely untouched by any kind of discipline. It just drives them even further away. And not only does the person resist it, but he stiffens his neck and hardens his heart even more against it. That was exactly Judah's attitude. That's exactly what happened all the days of Ahaz, who was absolutely no example to them. The Lord complained about that all throughout Jeremiah. He said in Jeremiah 2:30, "In vain have I smitten your children. They receive no correction." And then he continues later on, "Thou hast stricken them, but they have not grieved. Thou hast consumed them, but they have refused to receive correction. They have made their faces harder than a rock. They have refused to return." Jeremiah 5:3. Talking about the exact same thing that Isaiah is talking about. So, consequently then, the chastisements no longer are softening them. Instead, they harden them. The visitations that were meant to make them see the error of their ways, all they did was cause them to rebel all the more, and it evoked a kind of a revulsion in their hearts, which led to apostasy. Now, there are some, see the word why in verse 5? In Hebrew, we don't, like in English, has words why, where, when, how, who. We know what those words mean. In Hebrew, you'll have an ayin. We don't have an English equivalent for a Hebrew ayin. That's the ah sound, ayin, and an alamic. Okay, ayin, alamic. That's what the word is. And depending on the context, it can be why, it can be where, right? And many people think that the why should be aware. Now, I don't think so, but let's just play with that for a second. Let's suppose we change in the why for aware. Where should ye be stricken anymore? Which would be fascinating, because the implication then would be is that there was no part of the body left that hadn't become sick because of the blows that it had already received. There was no open space to whip anymore, you see. Now, that idea it's true, but ultimately, I don't see any reason to depart from the why. I think the why is the way to see it. But the prophet then, Isaiah, describes the moral sickness as well as the national chaos that these people found themselves in, resulting from their guilt and the punishment in the image of a person that suffers from the top of his head down to the bottom of his feet with one just giant ailment, this one mass of pus. And the illness is described as one that affects the whole body. Both the head and the heart, they're affected by it. Both the government and the people. So, consequently, the sickness is incurable, and essentially there's no hope for healing. And worse yet, there's no physician to squeeze the abscesses and clean the thing up to mollify the wounds. In fact, from the earliest times in the Orient, olive oil and figs were more than things that you ate. They were used for medicinal purposes. They were remedial. Just as in Judah, there was no balm in Gilead, nor a physician to recover the health of the sick one. Now that seems to be the case with this deplorable condition of these so-called people, of these people of God, and even today, of the so-called Christian nations. I'm talking about America, South America, Europe. All these nations claim to be Christian. I mean, there's hardly any doubt about it. The nations are decayed from the sole of the foot to the crown of the head. They are the world, these so-called Christian nations. There's not a single law or measure anymore that can bring improvement. With all their agitation, their activities, the nations get themselves deeper and deeper into disarrangement. If you don't believe me, go take a trip to Europe and find how much godliness you can find. There's none. I mean, the glory has departed, surely from England. There was a day not long ago when England was the spiritual capital of the world. It's not anymore. And all of Europe has gone that way. And America's following close behind. There's only one person that can cause the salvation to rise on these weary nations. They've got to return to Christ. We have to return to Christ. That brings us now to even a further comment on the desolation of Judah. Verse 7. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it in your presence. And it is desolate, as overthrown by strangers. So what Isaiah has just presented in the image of this repulsive sickness, now he's going to depict in a kind of like a few forceful, powerful strokes of reality. The fruitful land that God had given to the people, destroyed by invading armies. The cities had been burned to ashes, which is usually the case in war. Ancient warfare, when a conquering army moved in and conquered a people, they burned the place to the ground. That was even true in our Civil War. The foreign invaders destroyed the harvest right before the eyes of the people. They spent all year growing these crops. In one fell swoop, whoosh, they're gone. I mean, surely the people in those days were no worse than the civilized nations of today. I mean, in spite of all the cries about advancement, you know, they've not progressed for the better. They've regressed for the worst. One observation that I think should certainly be noted is, we need to be aware of the specifically prophetical and then in general Oriental style in these expressions, like your country is desolate. Now, we don't take that in an absolute literal sense, but it's a kind of a hyperbole for the destruction that comes about by these invading armies. And then again, in verse 7, it says, your cities are burned. It doesn't mean that not a single little town was left. But there was a lot of burning going on. Not everything, but there was a lot of burning going on. You have another example in verse 15. Your hands are full of blood. That doesn't mean that everybody's hands were literally full of blood. Unwashed, blood-covered hands. In the same way, David says that he made his bed to swim and watered his couch with tears. That those are all metaphorical expressions to heighten the imagery that God's trying to convey to us. Of John the Baptist, it said that all Judea and all Jerusalem went out to him. It doesn't mean that every person that lived in Judea went out to John the Baptist. You know, there's a limitation to the literalness that you take these statements with. All right, let's see if we can get maybe a couple more in here. Now he talks about a remnant from the judgment. Notice verse 8. And the daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Except the Lord of hosts, verse 9, had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been like unto Gomorrah. Now, this idea of a remnant occurs again and again in Isaiah. We're going to come back to that idea again. And I think that's why Paul also borrows the term and the concept in the book of Romans. But it's going to be sufficient to simply point out here the imagery used for indicating the remnant. In these larger vineyards back in those days, there were watchmen, and they were stationed to guard against anybody that would destroy thieves, wild animals. And so they built shacks to protect them from the heat of the day and the cold and dampness of the night. But now, watch this, the daughter of Zion, who's that? Who's the daughter of Zion there? Jerusalem, all right? She'd been left like such a shack amidst the general destruction. So, since cities are generally sought and admired and proud, Jerusalem, as the royal residential city and the city of the temple, is usually compared to a beautiful virgin, is normally the way Jerusalem is compared in the Old Testament. But now, with all those burnt cities and villages all around her, Jerusalem is a spectacle of loneliness and forsakenness. And the harvest that had been gathered, but the cottage had been left, you see. What a very striking simile of just this silent loneliness. Jerusalem, the besieged city. You see the word as? That's the simile. You'll see that again. The words as and like are similes. You see millions of them in Isaiah. And the as warns us not to think of the siege, particularly not the one by Sennacherib, right, the Assyrian. Isaiah doesn't want to ascribe the sparing of that city to the virtue of its inhabitants, but only to the saving grace of God. And the implication here is God could have let Jerusalem utterly perish just like Sodom and Gomorrah that lay under a heap of salt and burning ashes. God could have done that at that time. All right, we're done. But then in verses 10 and 11, he addresses the rulers and the people in general again. And we'll pick it up in verse 10 next time.